Hello, I'm David Eady. This is number 0605, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0605. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Mark Leslie, author of Fear and Longing in Los Angeles. It's the story of a small-town Canadian who turns into a wolf during the full moon.
Growing up reading Spider-Man comics and falling in love with sort of the idea of the superhero, particularly a mild-mannered Peter Parker who is a nerd, and Michael Andrews is very much that character. I describe him as an alpha wolf, but he's a beta human. And so he's dealing with the side effects of having enhanced powers and senses, even as a human, and using those powers to help other people.
Former CTV Montreal news anchor Paul Karwatsky, who quit his job to become the marketing and communications director for Giant Steps Foundation, to do his part in autism awareness.
One out of 66 children are diagnosed with autism these days, and public services are lacking. After diagnosis, you could wait on a waiting list for 3 years for early intervention. By the time 3 years are up, early intervention doesn't matter anymore. It's a huge burden on the system. You know, we need more services. So because of my experience, because of, you know, how I've seen parents struggling over the years, I figured one of the best things I could do is sort of dedicate myself to this, not only for my children, but for all the other parents out there, and try to do my small part to help out in that sense.
Stuart Nullman is in with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nullman. This time, Book Banter travels to Toronto to investigate a string of murders amongst the city's homeless population with Robert Rotenberg's novel, Downfall. The case gets open real soon on the Stuff File program.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0605, was a lifelong friend by the name of David Eady. He's a financial planner with the Wealth Management Group. David and I have known each other a very long time. Our parents knew each other before we were born. We went to school together. I was David's best man at his wedding. I think we know each other. Yeah. Thank you very much, Dave, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? There is a lot to be said for a little peace and quiet, especially when you have a neighbor who just will not shut up with her constant laundry. Oh, the rinsing, the spinning, the folding. Eventually, there is only one thing left to do. Kidnapping. A Vero Beach, Florida man is accused of abducting a neighbor after he claimed the woman and her husband were being too loud in their laundry room. Authorities with the Vero Beach Police Department said 61-year-old Leon Thurston entered the laundry room of Jessica Scoville's home with a black baton and a handgun. Investigators said Scoville's husband, David Scoville, was hit twice with the baton before Thurston grabbed Jessica by the wrist and took her from the home. David Scoville then called police for help. A search was launched for Jessica. When she flagged down police near Charles Park at around 7:30 a.m., Thurston was taken into custody, and officials said a gun was found in his pants. Jessica told authorities she asked Thurston to use a restroom and was able to get away and find help. Thurston faces numerous charges, including armed burglary, aggravated battery, and kidnapping. Oh, let's all pray that when he's convicted and goes to prison, that he's assigned to the prison laundry room. Oh, please. Pretty please. A pantless man was arrested after police spotted him enjoying the pleasure of his own company with a pickle while on a private premises. Responding to a suspicious person call, an officer saw 47-year-old Eric DeTiege lying on his back in front of a townhouse in Tampa Bay. He was not wearing pants or underwear, had his penis in one hand and a large uneaten pickle in his other hand. You can imagine where he was trying to stick that pickle. Detige was arrested on a misdemeanor exposure of sexual organs charge. He has prior convictions for theft, disorderly conduct, resisting police, and criminal mischief. He also has an arm tattoo that says, "Only God can judge me." Wow, that's the second person in less than a month who has that same tattoo in a story here on the Stuff File program. Well, so he too is probably going to jail. Like the last guy, may I suggest that maybe this guy get prison kitchen duty? Yeah. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, you may want to ask yourself, why is the court system perpetually clogged or at a standstill? Well, it's because of morons like Tyler Chamberlain. Let me tell you about Tyler, shall we? Tyler is from Nanaimo, British Columbia. He filed a lawsuit against the Insurance Corporation of British Columbia, claiming he suffered physical and emotional injuries in a 2018 road accident. He then amended his suit, adding other defendants, the Queen, the Prime Minister, the Premier, the Supreme Court of BC, Elections BC, and Nanaimo Regional General Hospital, among others. As compensation, noted BC Supreme Court Judge Douglas Thompson, Chamberlain demanded a private audience with Her Majesty, the suspension of trade with China, the dismantling of Transport Canada, the postponement of an election, the release of classified documents, the cleaning up of the swamp, the reconstruction of the RCMP, and an MRI for his entire body. Is that all? Nope. He also wants $32 trillion, that's with a T, $32 trillion, and 500,000 shares of Tesla stock. Thompson ruled the suit as scandalous, vexatious, and otherwise an abuse of process and dismissed it. And the judge added, if Chamberlain chooses to press the issue, he may also order him to pay the legal costs of the defendants. Well, if he was suffering from emotional injuries before, how do you think he's going to feel about the judge's ruling? Or is he just planning to add the judge to his list of litigants? I should stop talking now. Tyler might add me to the list. I do have one thing to add, though.
Stupid! You're so stupid!
Anyway, let's get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Mark Leslie is the author of Fear and Longing in Los Angeles, which follows the ongoing adventures of Michael Andrews, who is a small-town Canadian who has to deal with the fact that during the full moon, he turns into a wolf. Mark joins us via Skype from Waterloo, Ontario. Hi, Mark.
Hey, Peter. How you doing?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for being on the program with us. They always say, write what you know, so I'm curious, how did you start writing about werewolves?
Some might suggest it's because as I got older, hair was growing on all the different parts of my body, and maybe it meant that I was a wolf. But the writing what you know actually comes from growing up reading Spider-Man comics and falling in love with sort of the idea of the superhero, particularly a mild-mannered Peter Parker who is a nerd. And Michael Andrews is very much that character. I describe him as he is an alpha wolf, but he's a beta human. And so he's dealing with the side effects of having enhanced powers and senses, even as a human, and using those powers to help other people, because he can't help but recognize when somebody's in trouble because he can, kind of smell the danger or whatever. And he has enhanced strength. So it was kind of like, it was writing from that, maybe not necessarily what I know from personal experience, but something that I was very passionate about in the stories that I read growing up. And so a lot of that was infused in, I guess, in the tale of following this man around and seeing what he might do, given these extra powers that he's possessing.
Now, this is not your first novel dealing with this, but you have made your protagonist a small-town Canadian, and he's living in large cities in the United States. So there's a bit of a fish out of water aspect in this to this as well, isn't there?
Oh yeah, definitely. Yeah. And I'm glad you recognize that, because that is part of it as well, as I'm trying to demonstrate some of the nuances, because he's still, you know, while he's lived in Manhattan for a while, he still reflects back on the small town upbringing, and he's still not used to that. But the other thing that he learns especially in LA in this new novel and in Manhattan, is that it may be a large city, it may be a large metropolis, there may be a lot of people there, and you're probably familiar with this yourself in your own home city, there are neighborhoods that are very much small communities embedded within a larger city. There are communities of people that operate like a small town and in family ways. So he will look for and find communities within those larger cities that he can feel a part of, which is kind of maybe taking him back to, you know, to his roots.
Now, initially, as I mentioned, you had him in New York City, which is, by the way, where Peter Parker lives. But you've moved him to Los Angeles. Why the relocation?
So the play, the first book in the series was called A Canadian Werewolf in New York, which is an obvious nod to that American Werewolf in London, right? I wanted it to have this familiarity, but be like, wait a second, that's a little bit different. And the idea of having him go to LA, there was he needed to be separated from the woman, hit the love of his life, Gail, who they have a friendship and he wants more. And she's basically saying, you know what? No, we tried it once. It didn't work. This isn't going to work. And so he's kind of stuck in this rut. And so because he is a writer and there are movies being made from the books, I thought it would be fun to explore LA and send him to LA. Now, it was also inspired by, like, the first book came out of, I started writing it after my first trip to New York. And some ideas for the LA book came after, I think it was my second extended stay in you know, Hollywood / the LA area. And I thought, well, wouldn't it be fun to write about some of these places that, I've experienced personally? So again, yeah, I'm borrowing a lot from places that I know and I've been to.
You mentioned that one of your inspirations, of course, was Stan Lee and the Marvel world and Spider-Man. Of course, those characters that Stan Lee first created, you know, leapt from the pages and have worked their way onto both the small and big screen. Are you hoping that Michael Andrews will do the same?
I am not closing my mind to the possibility. I recognize that it's very unlikely that would ever happen, but I am open.
Well, hold on a second. Why do you say it's very unlikely?
Well, because, you know, there are only so many movies and television shows made off of, you know, tens of thousands of properties that are out there. So I recognize that it could happen, but I'm not banking on it. I want to write these stories. I have more Michael Andrews stories to tell. If somebody is interested, I'll definitely be interested in talking to them. Yeah, that would be awesome. My partner, she says when she read A Canadian Werewolf in New York, she thought it would make a great graphic novel. And I was like, yeah, if somebody wants to do it, of course I'll talk to them, right? I'd love to see their interpretation of the same story. So if Hollywood or television or somebody comes along and is interested in Michael Andrews, I'm more than willing to be open to that. But I'm not I'm not going to just sit around and hope for that. If it happens, it happens. And if it doesn't, I'm still happy to continue to tell his stories, if that makes sense.
Okay, so tell us about Fear and Longing in Los Angeles. First of all, what is the story about? And tell us about the title, especially the Fear and Longing part.
Yeah. Well, that comes back to me wanting to have cheeky nods to known books and movies. So obviously, people may be familiar with Hunter S. Thompson's Fear and Longing in Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, and it's definitely a play on that. But so Michael's in L.A. and he's longing for his love back home, trying to find his way to be distracted while he's there for several weeks on the movie set, and while there, he uncovers some seedy characters operating in sort of like a mob style underground who are attacking minority groups and viciously attacking like their hate groups, and there's hate crimes, and he's in the midst of uncovering this. So there's a lot of that fear. The city is captivated by fear because who knows when these people are going to strike. And of course, he uncovers the fact that they may have supernatural powers. And so it's a little bit scarier than just the average bad guy, because not only do they have hatred amongst other groups, and they're picking on particular members of society, but they have extra powers. So it's not just this powerful man going against thugs. It's a powerful man going against an organized crime of potentially super bad villains. And so that's all happening in the LA area. And that's kind of the genesis. So he's kind of in the process of finding new love. He meets a new woman, but she may have ties to this group. And so he's not sure. Can you trust anyone in Hollywood?
Because the plot takes place within the entertainment world, are there actual people within the story that are real that we would know?
Yeah, potentially. So Alicia Witt is an actress and a musician. And I know her through the indie music scene. I'm a huge fan of her music. She's been on numerous television shows and movies over the years. She does a lot of the Christmas Hallmark movies. She does a lot of those romantic comedies, but she's been on Law & Order. She's been on Friday Night Lights, so many different TV shows. Well, I've connected with her via the music scene in the past, and she allowed me to write her in as a character. And I actually have a pivotal scene where Michael realizes it's time to get over this past love. And it happens while he's watching Alicia Witt perform at the hotel cafe where, when she lived in LA, she regularly performed. It was a phenomenal music venue, very intimate music venue. And so I actually have a scene where they interact. And when I sent it to Alicia, just to get her approval, to make sure, because I put words in her mouth, she loved it. And she said, actually, wow, I could see myself saying those things in that moment. Really nicely done. Congratulations. So I was so pleased that she liked it, too.
Well, now, of course, you realize that when this is made into a film, it has to be done. If only she could play herself.
I think she, as an actress, she'd have no problem playing herself really, really well. And as a musician, like, she is so talented. She is such a brilliant performer that she also allowed me to use the lyrics in the book, which, getting that from a studio would be impossible and would cost thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of dollars. But Alicia owns the rights to her music because she's an indie musician, and she's allowed me the use of her lyrics, which is phenomenal. So, I mean, obviously she'd have to play some of her songs in that movie too, which would make it that much of a better movie.
You wouldn't make her audition, would you?
No, she pretty much has the role, okay, provided she's available, right? You know, unless she's doing some other Oscar type performance. So
how much research did you have to do when you first started writing this character? In dealing with the werewolf aspect of it?
So a lot of it was trying to understand what would it be like to actually have this curse where you turn into an actual wolf during the full moon. You have no control over what happens. It's like, you know, the old Incredible Hulk, where he turns into the monster and he wakes up somewhere and he has no idea what's going on. So a lot of it was, how would I deal in that situation? Because I consider myself a mild-mannered, meeky, nerdy kind of guy. And just kind of followed the situation from there. So a lot of the research was being physically in the places and understanding them. Talking to people who lived there and knew the neighborhoods better than I did. And a lot of Google Maps where you can do Street View, where I actually in one scene where I was in the Fear and Longing in Los Angeles, was a place where he's walking from the bar back to his hotel. And I have never walked that route. So I actually got onto Google Street View and I basically walked through Google Street View till I got to a spot going, this parking lot, this is where it's going to happen. This is where he's going to meet the thugs. and so the research was a lot of fun.
Well, the book is called Fear and Longing in Los Angeles. It's part of a series that features Michael Andrews. It's written by Mark Leslie. And Mark, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Peter, thank you so much. It's been my honor.
Mark Leslie, author of Fear and Longing in Los Angeles. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0605, and you'll find the link to Mark's site, plus links to either amazon.com or amazon.ca, where you can order his books directly. You're listening to The Stuff File Program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File Program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like. But the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. You're experiencing The Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder. Sit back, relax, let it rattle around between your ears, tickling your cerebellum, and enjoy.
And still to come in the program, we'll talk to former TV news anchor Paul Karwatsky about autism awareness. Plus, Stuart Nullman will be along with another edition of Book Banter. And we do indeed have an Idiot of the Day and lots more Stuff File news here on a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, a Georgia man who was expecting his final paycheck from a former employer said the money instead arrived in the form of 500 pounds of oil-covered pennies dumped in his driveway in the middle of the night. Andreas Flotten said he submitted his 2 weeks' notice in writing in November, and Miles Walker, the owner of Walker Luxury Auto Works in Peachtree City, had a noticeable negative reaction, said Flotten. He gets up, puts his hands on his head, walks out the door, and disappears for like an hour. Flotten, who said he left the job due to a toxic work environment, said he was still owed $915, which the owner told him would be delivered in January. He said the owner accused him of damages when he called to inquire about the check not arriving at his home, so he contacted Georgia's Department of Labor. Flotten said the money then showed up as 500 pounds of oil-covered pennies that were dumped in his driveway. Flotten's girlfriend posted a video to Instagram showing the messy pile of pennies when they showed up outside the home. Walker, who seems like a real piece of work, said he couldn't recall if he dumped the pennies at Flotten's home. Here's what he had to say when he was contacted by Jamie Kennedy from the local CBS affiliate.
I don't know if I did that or not. I don't really remember. It doesn't matter. He got paid. That's all that matters. He's a f***ing weenie for even bringing it up.
Isn't that class all the way? Oh, it gets better. Walker was asked why he thought his former employee was a weenie. And here's his response.
Because he is, and because you guys give him a platform. I just told you exactly what I had to say. You guys are what's wrong with the world. Get the f*** off my property, okay?
There's a lot more to this story, including testimonials from other former employees of Mile Walker's happy home of HR hijinks. Let's just hope that when the PR dust settles from all of this, Andreas will get a job more fitting for a human being, and Walker Luxury Auto Works, that's Walker Luxury Auto Works, gets all the proper publicity and business it deserves. Okay, I want to take a moment to discuss the heinous issue of voter fraud in the United States. 50-year-old Laura Rose Carroll and her 17-year-old daughter, Emily Rose Grover, were arrested in Pensacola, Florida on March the 16th after an investigation by the Florida Department of Law Enforcement found the duo had allegedly stuffed the ballot box with votes for Emily for homecoming queen last fall. Suspicions were raised when the Escambia County School District reported illegal accessing of hundreds of its students' digital accounts. Authorities said Carroll, an assistant elementary school principal, had access to the district student information system, and investigators traced unauthorized entries into the system to Carroll's cell phone and computers, where nearly 250 votes were cast. Investigators also said students reported being told by Grover about her mother's activities. Each of them was charged with offenses against computers and other cybercrimes, along with conspiracy. Oh, this election fraud must be stopped. This is no way to run a democracy. Also, haven't these two ever seen a Reese Witherspoon movie? And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, Well, now that we've covered voter fraud, let's talk about fake news. 50-year-old Rafaela Spohn was arrested in early March in Bucks County, Pennsylvania, after prosecutors said she created deepfake videos and photographs of at least three girls on her daughter's cheerleading squad in an apparent attempt to embarrass them and force them off the team. Prosecutors said Spohn allegedly sent the manipulated images to the girls, shown drinking, smoking, and naked, anonymously, and suggested they kill themselves. Parents of one of the recipients contacted police, and detectives traced the IP address where the messages originated to Spohn's home. Investigators believe Spohn's daughter was unaware of what her mother was doing. Well, that's an awkward dinner conversation. I have one thing to say about these last two parental units in this and the previous story. Either one of them could be considered
the bad mother.
Yep. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Former Montreal CTV news anchor Paul Karwatsky left his anchor desk behind in 2019 to become the head of marketing and communications at Giant Steps Foundation. Giant Steps Foundation offers financial support to the Giant Steps School, a private school that welcomes students aged 4 to 21 years old with autism spectrum disorders. Paul joins us via Skype from right here in Montreal. Hi, Paul.
How's it going?
Nice to talk with you once again, sir. Pleasure to have you on the program with us.
This is very exciting. I was just telling you how you are perhaps my favorite radio show host of all time.
Wow. Now I'm blushing. Well, thank you, sir. I want to talk about what you do as your job of head of marketing and communications at Giant Steps Foundation. We should mention the fact that you have two children who are on the spectrum, and you left your job, a full-time, high-profile job, to become the head of marketing and communications at Giant Steps Foundation. What exactly is your mandate in your job?
My mandate is, it's autism advocacy. It's not drawing more people to the school, because one of the major issues with the school is that we have to reject 9 out of every 10 applicants because there's no room. So, I mean, that's just reflective of the demand out there for the services, you know, much needed services. You know, 1 out of 66 children are diagnosed with autism these days, and public services are lacking. And that's something, as a parent, that I of course experienced after diagnosis. You could wait on a waiting list for 3 years for early intervention. By the time 3 years are up, early intervention doesn't matter anymore, and then the public schooling system's supposed to handle all these kids if they're able to be integrated. It's a huge burden on the system, and you know, we need more services. So because of my experience, because you know how I've seen parents struggling over the years, I figured one of the best things I could do is sort of dedicate myself to this, not only for my children but for all the other parents out there, and try to do a small part to help out in that sense.
Well, I'm assuming that as a professional communicator, which you are, there is an advantage to being able to share some of your story in a way that is helpful to other parents. Because I would assume that when a diagnosis like this first comes about, you go through all kinds of stages as to emotions that you might go through, from fear, from the unknown, from maybe even guilt, thinking maybe you've done something wrong in the process, or that it's something that's genetic. I'm sure all these things must go through your mind when you first hear about this.
Yeah, it's a crazy process. Of course, you know, we all hear about autism. You know, once we're expecting, we all think about it and think about it as a possibility, but no one really knows what it means. And, you know, I remember first getting that diagnosis, and it feels like, you know, things are over. This is it. This is a terrible diagnosis. And it is a serious thing, of course. But then as you know, as it kind of develops, you realize that these kids have a lot to offer, and adults with autism have a lot to offer. And in a lot of cases, it's just a different way of seeing the world, and it's a different way of interacting with the world. And you know, obviously it comes with challenges, and it comes with difficulties, communication difficulties, but there's a lot there to work with, and not only work with, but to be proud of and to learn from. So gradually you realize, well, you know, these kids have a place in society. And people with autism have a place in society, and society really needs to adapt to welcome them and to tap into their potential. So, you know, that's really what I'm dedicating myself to, and you know, really what I'm working towards, you know, obviously primarily motivated by, you know, forging a place for my own children, but also, you know, really being part of that community of neurodiversity, that movement, you know, it's fascinating to me. And it's actually, it's very exciting to me as well.
I would assume that one of the things that's very important for any child on the spectrum is a sense of normalcy and a sense of regimen that comes with whatever educational process they're going through. And let's be honest, that is not the world we're living in right now. How much more difficult has this past year been because of what we've all gone through with the pandemic?
Oh, it's been extremely difficult. I mean, it's been difficult for everyone. You know, I think there's a notion that, that special needs individuals are struggling more with it, and some are. And listen, you know, some are thriving too, because, you know, a lot of people with autism sort of thrive through computer learning as well. They thrive through computer based communication, and some, you know, it's impossible to learn over the computer. So I think, you know, has the special needs community been suffering more than the neurotypical community? I don't think so. I think we've all kind of been in this together, and it's all been sort of a crazy situation, and it's just something that hopefully is coming to an end, because you know, I've had it, my kids have had it, and it's just time to get back to the regular way of doing things, I think.
How?
But does it affect the special needs community more? I think in many ways it does, and in many ways it doesn't. It affects us all pretty badly, I think.
How worried are you about the future? Because there are some concerns as to the employment situations for adults with autism.
Just to go back to your initial question, part of the reason I was brought on for Giant Steps specifically, you know, Giant Steps, of course, it's a school, it's a private school, but it's publicly subsidized. So it actually doesn't cost anything more than public school to go to. But part of the reason I was brought on was not just to be a communications person for the school, but they have some really huge, exciting projects. And that's why they really needed a comms person. And one of them is, you know, this big adult employment initiative called Polaris Enterprise. It's a partnership with Loblaws. And it's really based on this Walgreens initiative in the States. I don't know if you heard of it, but it's pretty big. And it changed the way companies approached neurodiverse hiring in the States. And it started with this crazy VP executive by the name of Randy Lewis. And he had a grandchild on the spectrum. And he decided to take this heavily automated processing plant in South Carolina for Walgreens. And he told all the managers, he said, listen, 30% of your workforce is going to be disabled. And that could be on the spectrum, any disability. And you have to hire 30% of people you hire have to be disabled. And if you don't make it work, you're basically fired. And it was this big litmus test as to whether this could be possible. And what happened was, and so they did it, and a few managers were fired. And then basically everybody had to adapt. And once they adapt, they did studies, and they found that the plant where there were 30% of the workforce was neurodiverse was more productive, was more efficient, morale was boosted tremendously. And so a lot of companies in the States started following suit, like Microsoft, Deloitte, EY, like all these companies have these big, you know, neurodiverse hiring initiatives now. In Canada, we're lagging behind. So Giant Steps launched Polaris Enterprise, and this is in collaboration with Loblaws. And we're really trying to get this off the ground. And right now we have the first cohort of about 20 participants who are going through the process of training, and Loblaws has agreed to give them jobs at the end of this. So hopefully they take this on nationally. That's our goal. It's been very successful so far. And then hopefully other companies follow suit. So that's one of the big projects. Another big project that I've been sort of taken on to help promote is we're launching a new state-of-the-art autism center for Montreal. And it's going to be this amazing center that is the first of its kind in North America, where there's going to be a school, there's going to be a research hub, there's going to be a resource and community hub, and there's going to be an adult education hub. And it's all going to be under one roof, and it's going to be embedded within the Technopole Angus in Rosemont-la-Petite-Patrie. And this is a huge sort of living laboratory, residential, commercial, industrial neighborhood where, you know, Ubisoft has offices and all these high-tech companies have offices. So this center is going to be integrated within all this, and it's going to be the first of its kind in Canada and the first of the model in North America. So that's pretty exciting. So these are two huge projects that have been brought on to help promote, and they have the potential to set a new standard for how this country approaches neurodiversity. So it's pretty big, pretty big.
How are your two kids doing?
They're doing great. They're not at Giant Steps. They're at Summit, which is sort of the competition school. But we enrolled them in Summit right before I got the job at Giant Steps. But Summit's another great school. And they were in regular schooling for the longest time. And they were doing well academically. But socially, you know, I always felt they were kind of on the fringe. You know, like society isn't – it's not there yet. And a lot of schools do a wonderful job at integration. The English Montreal School Board does a wonderful job at integration. But, you know, the fact is it's not just about academics and it's not just about grades. It's about really changing the way we perceive, you know, people with these kinds of conditions. So we decided to switch them at the Summit specifically for the social aspect and just all the aspects besides academics. You know, and they're doing really great there. They're really thriving. And, it's been a huge learning process for them and for us. But no, they're doing great. And they are great. They're great little kids. And they have a lot of potential. And they teach me things every day. And it's, the biggest motivation is just to try to show the world how amazing these people are, you know.
So for any parent out there listening right now who might have just got a diagnosis that their child is on the spectrum, what do you want to tell them?
Yeah, I don't know. The one thing that keeps cropping up are two main points, and is that you're your child's best advocate. Throughout life, you're really going to have to advocate for them, and you can't wait on the system. And the schooling will help you out, but you can't wait on that. You got to believe in your children and believe they have a place in society and things are going to be okay. And the other thing, and it seems like a contradictory statement, but although you're your child's only advocate, it takes a town to raise these kids. It takes a village to raise these kids. So you also have to depend on the services that are out there. And you know, one of the things that inspired me to make this move is just the help I've received over the years. There's so many great organizations. You know, there's a problem with the public system, but there's so many parental organizations out there. There's so many other organizations that are helping to fill the gap. And you really got to take advantage of those. You know, just you can't sit by and expect, you know, people to take care of your kids. You got to find those services. Those services are out there and you got to believe in your kids. And everything will be fine.
Well, continued success with all you do. People can find out more information by going to the website, which is giantstepsmontreal.com. Paul, I thank you very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Thanks so much, Peter. Thanks for having me.
Paul Karwatsky, the head of marketing and communications at Giant Steps Foundation. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the number for this show, which is show number 0605, and you'll find the link to their site. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
Got something for the mailbag? Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. Send your email to mailbag@thestufffile.com. And remember, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's mailbag@thestufffile.com. Or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Often I mention my book, Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. I also often mention that I'd like you to become a patron of the Stuff File program via patreon.com. Well, this is my opportunity to combine both of those pleas to you. You've heard me say on many occasions about the myriad of celebrities I've had the chance to talk to that are contained in my book, which is published by Bear Manor Media. You've also heard me mention that some of the celebrities in my book, and many others, can be heard on our page at patreon.com. Well, if you've been on the fence about joining Patreon, let me try to pull you over to our side. By becoming a patron, you help to make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. And if you do become a regular patron, as a Patreon reward, I'll share with you an electronic version of my book for your e-reader. So join Patreon and claim your copy of Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. Sign up today at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
From our studios in Montreal, Canada, and going out to the rest of the world, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nauman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And to let us know what is criminal in Toronto, here is Stuart Nauman. Hi, Stu.
Hi, Peter. I thought you were going to say the Maple Leafs for a second.
No, I said criminal. I didn't say DOA.
Yeah, there is a difference. You're absolutely right. I stand corrected.
Yes.
But Peter, on this edition of Book Banter, we are going to look at crime in Toronto, not the history of crime, but a crime, a fictional crime, with a novel called Downfall. But let me preface this for you. It's a strange thing happened early one cold winter morning as Jember Roshan rode his bike to work at the Humber River Golf Club. And as he was about to arrive at this exclusive elite Toronto golf club to start his working day, Jember was rear-ended by a black SUV. The impact of the hit catapulted him from his bike and sent him rolling down the steep grade that led to the banks of the Humber River. His fall was broken not by a rock or a tree, but a dark, spongy object. That's right. And that spongy object was the body of a dead homeless woman who made her home in a squatter's camp near the club.
Wow. Now,
yeah,
I'm guessing a story about a Toronto country club. The only thing in that story that's black is the SUV.
Well, it could be, but I've never been to that club, so I couldn't tell you. I only know what I read.
Okay.
Now, when the coroner discovers that the dead woman's cause of death was a blunt force trauma to the back of the skull from a vodka bottle, there's an uproar across the city by both the homeless community and the wealthy members of the golf club to solve this brutal murder. But when the bodies of two more homeless people are found in the same area with the same death-causing injuries, then the pressure is on Toronto Police Homicide Squad detectives Ari Green and Daniel Kennicott to investigate the murders and catch the perpetrator before it explodes into a full-blown killing spree against the city's less fortunate residents.
I just want to know, are the people at the country club really concerned about this murder because they feel it's the improper use of vodka?
No, and it's not even the improper use of a beer bottle, not even that.
Okay.
No, and it's more like, well, you're going to make us look bad, you know, if it gets publicity and it's going to hurt the membership and what have you, you know, that kind of concern.
Mm.
You know, what, so like the
why do I get the feeling that every person from the country club in this story, when you read the book, sounds like Thurston Howell III?
Well, because they probably are.
Oh, okay.
But that's the premise behind Robert Rotenberg's latest police thriller. It's called Downfall. Now, what I liked about this book is how its double-barreled purpose of solving a string of murders and creating awareness of the plight of a major city's homeless population practically grabs your attention from page one. In fact, it almost reads like a script from an episode of Law & Order. It doesn't matter which spinoff from that TV franchise that first comes to mind. But this time, it's not just the police and the lawyers who are on the case, but a number of other characters that are not directly involved in law enforcement, but somehow have a stake in this particular crime. So it's sort of like, you know, an all-star cast of different people who are there for that common purpose of solving the murders. Hmm. Think of it as the longest day, you know, crime-wise.
Yes.
But Rotenberg takes these subplots and neatly brings them all together towards the capture of the murderer, and practically each character contributes towards a satisfying denouement that concludes Downfall. As well, his grim descriptions of Toronto's underbelly brings out the sad fact of how the plight of the homeless population taints the city's image as Canada's largest city or as Toronto the Good. But Downfall is a gripping detective thriller that explicitly exposes the division between rich and poor, but also brings to light of the tragedy of being homeless and dispossessed that should not be treated as a social burden, but as a national emergency.
And by the way, the intersection of rich and poor is not Jane and Finch. I'm just saying that right now.
No, I don't even think it's Young and Dundas either.
No, but it certainly is Rosedale.
Never been there before.
I don't know if you're allowed.
I don't know, Peter. Next time I go to Toronto, I'm going to give it a shot and I'll let you know what happens.
Okay.
So that's so the book is Downfall by Robert Rotenberg, and it's published by Simon & Schuster, and it's $22.
And what are some of the other stories you suggest within this genre, sir?
Well, I was thinking about it, and I thought of two books in which the geographical location plays just as much an important role as the cast of characters in the books.
Okay.
Okay. So first of all, may I recommend Death on the Nile by Agatha Christie?
Oh, of course. Absolutely.
It's a Hercule Poirot mystery where he solves a murder of a young bride while him and a group of people are cruising along the Nile River in the 1930s. Think of it as Murder on the Orient Express on a boat.
Right.
Think of it that way. And the next one I highly recommend is a novel, a murder mystery called The Maine by Trevanian, who gave you the Iger sanction. And this novel takes place on the Maine, St. Lawrence Boulevard in Montreal, but during a time when it was not just known as a cultural thoroughfare, but also as part of the seamy underside of Montreal as well.
Well, underneath that same heading, could you also include Dirty Kravitz?
Yeah, you could. I mean, it's not a mystery, but it's
That's true.
A book where the location plays just as much a major role as the characters that are in it.
Okay, if you want another, if you want a mystery that still involves Quebec, Agnes of God.
True. That's true. It was a play.
Yeah.
And a Broadway play, and, you know, became a movie with Jane Fonda and Meg Tilly. And one more, speaking of Quebec. But
yes.
It was based on a short story, I Confess, which was made to a movie by Alfred Hitchcock with Montgomery Clift in 1953, which was all shot on location in Quebec City. And it wasn't disguised as another city. It was taking place in Quebec City.
Right. And speaking of Hitchcock, is it North by Northwest? That's the one with Martin Landau who comes to... North by Northwest. Location plays another great role in that story, in that movie. Now we're getting off of books, but you know what I mean.
Yeah. You think of Mount Rushmore.
Absolutely. Yes.
Oh, exactly. Exactly. But, you know, I think, you know, what happens if they were tickling like George Washington's nose and he just, you know, Washington just started laughing.
No, sneezed.
Then goodbye, Cary Grant and Ava Marie Saint.
There you go. Well, we've really gone off the beaten path on that one, haven't we?
Yeah, but we sort of kept to the theme.
Okay, we kind of kept to the theme. Seriously, though, offhand, I'm going to put you on the spot. Other books, I mean, you mentioned a couple. Other books, other mysteries where the location plays such an important role.
Ooh.
Because I know you've read a lot of them. I'm trying to think offhand myself.
Well, there's Agatha Christie one, and then there were none, which is a remote English island.
Could you toss in the Da Vinci Code?
Yes, because it's the Vatican.
Yeah.
And also the 39 Steps, which was written by John Buchan, who later became Lord Tweedsmuir, the Governor General of Canada during the late 1930s. That one involved the chase from London to Scotland, and especially the Scotland part plays quite a major role in the latter part of the book. Mm.
I knew I couldn't put someone who was once on Reach for the Top on the spot like that. I knew you'd come through.
Nice try.
I knew you'd come through. Okay, so again, this week's book is?
Called Downfall by Robert Rotenberg. It's published by Simon & Schuster, and it's $22 in trade paperback.
And which mysterious location can we find you?
Well, not at Styles with Hercule Poirot, but in the pages of the Montreal Times, you know, every week, published on Saturday or online at www.mtltimes.ca.
Excellent, sir. Thank you very much, Stu.
Oh, you're welcome, Peter. Now I just got to enjoy the rest of that cruise down the Nile.
Okay. Stuart Nelman with another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we're just about a racetrack for this edition of the Stuff File program. I do have a few Stuff File news stories and an idiot of the day to get to, So let's get to it. Perhaps looking to broaden their horizons, a Pennsylvania duo romped around a posh New Jersey home, having sex and eating up the food they found. The couple allegedly broke into the home and did the deed, all while a babysitter and young child were still in the house. Apparently, the couple, identified as Alex Ray Yeakley and Amanda Lentz, thought they had the place to themselves. According to a police press release, as the investigation continues, it is believed that the pair had been inside the home for a period of time before they were discovered. The babysitter heard Lentz on a baby monitor while the baby slept and initially thought the homeowner had returned. The babysitter confronted the pair at around 10:30 p.m. and they left, but not before allegedly lifting jewelry, a wallet, and the homeowner's iPhone. The pair also stole a Lincoln Navigator. Unfortunately for the couple, the stolen iPhone was tracked, and police used spike strips to send their vehicle careening into a field. The horny duo was then arrested. Let me just take this moment for a public service announcement, especially to you young people out there. Kids, if you're planning to break into a house to steal stuff and have sex, please, please, please use protection. Thank you. An Italian army tank taking part in military exercises in northern Italy mistakenly blew up a chicken coop, killing a large number of birds. The accident happened on the outskirts of Vivaro, a small town close to an army shooting range. The farm owners discovered the damage the next morning when they saw that their chicken shed had partially collapsed and many birds had perished. Local media reported that magistrates have opened an investigation and impounded the tanks involved in the exercise. I know the saying is you have to break a few eggs to make an omelet, but you don't need a tank to do that. I can just see the headline for this story. Chicken farmer cries foul as Italian tank blows the coop. Anyway, boys and girls, it's that moment you've all been waiting for. It's time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This stuff file presents the Idiot of the Day.
A husband accused of killing his wife and who taunted police over the search for her body was arrested when investigators found her remains in his backyard. Police charged 66-year-old Roberto Colon with the first-degree murder of his 44-year-old wife, Mary Stella Gomez Mullet. Investigators found her remains buried in Colon's backyard a week after investigators say he bragged, "At least you didn't find a body," during a search of his house. Gomez Mullet was an immigrant working as a caretaker for Colon's mother, who suffered from dementia, and in exchange he married her weeks after they had met so that she could obtain U.S. citizenship. After finding plenty of circumstantial evidence, including human bloodstains, investigators returned February 26th to search Colon's house again. He taunted them, yelling, "Find the body! Find the body!" Investigators found marijuana. When they left, police say, Colon smirked and said, "Well, at least you didn't find a body at my house." Police returned to the house and arrested him on drug possession charges. "There's one thing they can't do," Colon said, while police believe he thought he was out of earshot. "They can't put Humpty Dumpty back together again." But in Colon's backyard, investigators unearthed human remains. Fingerprint analysis identified them as belonging to his wife. Now, why? Oh, why? Would you taunt police about not finding the body of your wife at your home when, as everybody knows, when a wife goes missing, the first person they suspect is the husband, and the second thing they suspect is she's buried somewhere on the property? Well, one reason, and one reason only. You're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0605. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0605. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder. And don't forget to check us out on Patreon.com, or you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including the podcast station, CyberStationUSA.com, Verdant Square Radio, KDXRadio.com, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on Apple or Google Podcasts, streaming on Spotify, Stitcher, and iHeartRadio, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, CKUWFM in Winnipeg, and CKHR in Hay River. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. If you were listening to this at the same time as watching The Wizard of Oz and listening to Pink Floyd's The Dark Side of the Moon, well, it's a waste of electricity. There are some things you just can't multitask.